Smart cities and big data. You've heard lots of boffins and tech types talking about both over the years, but somehow it often seems a bit abstract. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense. You're going to hear about two fascinating and controversial projects today, one in Canada and one in China. Both are huge in their implications and, surprisingly, have received very little in the way of mainstream media coverage. Canada is our first stop, Toronto, a company called Sidewalk Labs, and a certain photogenic politician.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. What a pleasure to be back here talking about the future of the waterfront in this great city. It's great to be back in Toronto. I want to thank Waterfront.
Sidewalk Labs is a firm owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. And as you can hear, they have Justin Trudeau's approval and endorsement. They're being given a parcel of land on the city's waterfront to redevelop from the ground up as a prototype smart city of the future.
Waterfront Toronto and Sidewalk Labs are partnering to create a new kind of urban community on the waterfront, one that will be an exemplar to the rest of the world of how to build cities that have the greatest impact on our future.
Addressing the challenges that Toronto has requires a different way of thinking. I like the fact that Sidewalk is bringing a different approach that includes both planning and process and community and technology together, rethinking how we build cities in the 21st century.
One of those enthusiastic about the project is Toronto-based urban designer Ken Greenberg.
Project Sidewalk is intending to use a neighborhood in Toronto on the waterfront as a kind of test bed or lab to try out a whole series of ideas relating to how technology could be brought to bear on major urban issues of the day, everything from environmental concerns to housing affordability to better options for mobility, for waste management, for climate attenuation, for how we use buildings and accommodate radical mixed use. And we're now in a one-year period where this is sort of testing proof of concept to see if there is a basis to go forward. So at the end of this year, some kind of proposal will come forward, which will go to the board of Waterfront Toronto and to City of Toronto politicians for review and hopefully approval in order to proceed into more detailed phases of the project. It's a 12-acre site called Quayside, which is surrounding on both sides of a slip at the edge of Toronto Harbour. But in fact, the reach of the project could be much more significant. It could extend into a much larger area of the surrounding portlands in terms of some of the ideas that may be developed within this test bed. And ultimately, what we're really talking about here are concepts and ideas, approaches, tools that could be used generally throughout the urban region and indeed in cities around the world. So think of this really as a kind of R&D lab to test the validity of some of these ideas and their feasibility.
And the sorts of tools already being talked about include self-driving shuttles instead of cars, ice-melting footpaths, and a system allowing Sidewalk Labs to turn off any lights in your apartment that you've accidentally left on. Crucially, the selling point for the concept is the digital layer that will underpin the urban development. A system of monitors and sensors observing and recording everything from a household's electricity and internet usage to how often a toilet is flushed. It's all about ensuring efficiency. But that's where the skeptics get nervous. Post the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, some like Dr. Jathan Sadowski at the University of Sydney worry about putting a private company like Google in charge of the stuff of urban life.
What's in it for them? It's data. So it's a new source of data. It allows them to get a really granular, massive amounts of data about urban life and urban environments. How do people behave? How are they living? What kind of energy profiles, transportation? Ultimately, they're a data company, so something like this is very valuable for them. As far as what's in it for Toronto, You know, cities right now are in this drive to constantly grow. There's austerity, they're in competition with each other for resources. And so this is kind of translated into city leaders expending a lot of energy courting the tech sector as this locus of investment and innovation. The technology sector has a lot of money and a lot of expendable liquid assets. City leaders are looking to get a piece of that and looking for the tech sector as a way to kind of fight against austerity, as a way to win out in this competition for resources over other cities. And so that's what they're hoping they get in return, although it's not clear at all that Toronto will gain any useful insights from the data that Google collects. It's not clear that this kind of quayside redevelopment will actually lead to a massive boom in economic prosperity. All of it is kind of based on hoping. It's all based on the potential of these massive technology corporations, these extremely wealthy corporations, to come in and say, you know, look, we're a really successful company and we can make your city really successful too.
Now, we've heard on this program numerous times about the ideal of the smart city of the future, a city where everything is hyper-connected, you know, the Internet of Things. In one sense, this is the dream version, isn't it, of that ideal, if you believe in that kind of city.
It's definitely a version and a really explicit version of it. This represents not only a kind of standalone initiative or even a cluster of initiatives, but a kind of handing over of an entire district to a technology corporation to kind of mold it in their own image. So I think it represents that vision, but I think it also heightens many of the issues that smart cities bring with them. It really puts an emphasis on issues around not only privacy and security, but urban politics and urban governance.
Because at Sidewalk Labs, if this proposal does actually eventually go ahead, Sidewalk Labs will not only be designing this section of the city, but it will also be running it, won't it? It'll operate. It'll be in charge of the operation of this precinct.
That's right. I mean, they'll be in charge of the city planning and also the city managing. So it really does become their own kind of sovereign territory within Toronto, this mini city.
Now, we've seen in the past, we've seen where governments, where local authorities have given over areas of cities, large areas of cities, to corporations, often for, you know, integrated casino resort development areas, that kind of thing. How is this different from that kind of handing over of precincts in the past?
So while American cities and cities around the world are no stranger to privatization, the entrance of tech giants into urban development paves the way for a few different developments, right? So it paves the way for a long-term reorganization of this local power. So now you have a city that's based on or built around proprietary platforms, data harvesting, corporate control. So it's not just about allowing a company to run a city service or giving them the ability to develop a big casino or something like that. It cuts much deeper and it really gets to issues around sovereignty, around accountability, and what the public good means and who's to deliver the public good.
And those concerns are also uppermost in Ken Greenberg's mind. His support of the project and involvement as an advisor is based on the hope and expectation, he says, that the needs of citizens will be paramount.
My point of view in this whole thing is that I'm looking for what I would call a human-centered urbanism enabled by technology rather than a technology-driven approach to city-making, which makes some of the human values or the kinds of things that we would be looking for in terms of where we want the city of Toronto and other cities to go submerged by the technology. That's not the point here.
And that's a real danger, isn't it, with any project like this, that the human side of things, you know, gets lost to an extent because of the focus on technology.
That, well, it's precisely that has led me to want to be involved in this, because I think whether or not we have specific high-profile projects like this, The technology is upon us. It's taking over all aspects of our daily lives, wherever we live. And this is a real opportunity to ask some really hard questions about privacy, about who controls data, about how it's used, about in what circumstances do we actually want sensors being involved in terms of the technology of things. When do we want to go to no-tech or low-tech solutions as opposed to technologically driven solutions? So there's a whole lot of value testing that will be going on here, which I think is really important. And to have an opportunity to do that very publicly and very transparently, I think is really important.
And this project is being described as an urban living laboratory. Within that, then, there will be residents concerns over residents' consent. So how much say would you like to see residents having in the way in which this project goes ahead?
I think that's a very critical aspect. And part of this initial formulation of the proposal is focused on those issues of consent and privacy and the anonymity of data of certain types and issues of consent. So working out a protocol, which is well understood, and, you know, we're certainly seeing examples rising in the news every day in the world now of people whose data is being surreptitiously taken one way or another without their consent. So this is really top of mind, I think, for people in Toronto who are looking at this project and to see actually how this might work.
Ken Greenberg, an urban designer and principal with Greenberg Consultants in Canada. Whether or not civic authorities in Toronto give the final go-ahead to Sidewalk Lab's Smart City project won't be known until later this year. But even if it does go ahead, with all of the power and money of Google behind it, that's no guarantee of success, as urbanist and London-based author Adam Greenfield points out.
I understand that there is a deal in the works, but what remains unclear is precisely what Sidewalk is proposing to do in Toronto. And I think so far they've been given the benefit of the doubt by the media, the general public, and more or less all concerned. But I think it behooves everyone involved to start asking questions about precisely what it is that's on the table. What are they proposing to do? And I think that there is an extraordinary lack of clarity about that to date. Generally speaking, I find that installations of network technology in public space at the scale of the city fail to benefit the public in the way that we are promised that they will. We just see this time and time again. Nobody likes being that person, right? Nobody likes being Cassandra. Nobody likes being the person who says, look, I told you so. But I've been doing this for, you know, 15 or 20 years now. And there is at this point a track record of communities in which the smart city has been rolled out fairly aggressive. And when I say the smart city, I mean the entire package of sensors built into the landscape and communication and computation devices built into all of the buildings and the infrastructures and the public spaces. And what we see is that they invariably fall short of the very aggressive claims that are made for them. So, you know, you see in a place like New Songdo City in South Korea, where it was supposed to be an absolute state-of-the-art community in which robotic delivery vehicles cruised the streets and made automated parcel deliveries, and in which all of the apartments were wired together with telepresence. Very, very little of that has ever come to pass. And the community is sort of, it's never really taken off. People have moved in there, but only because it's relatively cheap residential real estate, not because of the technological glamour associated with it. In places like Masdar, a city that was built from the ground up in Abu Dhabi to showcase these technologies, it's virtually a ghost town. And some of the other places that were promoted to us as recently as 5 or 6 years ago as being, you know, exemplar smart cities of the future never even broke ground. They just don't exist. They never have. So it's really, really hard to assess, certainly in any particularly concrete way, whether technologies that are deployed in this way have ever benefited anybody but the people selling them. They don't seem to shed any greater benefit upon the public.
This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and we'll endeavour to keep watch on that initiative in Toronto and report back later in the year.
China is nothing if not innovative when it comes to finding ways to exert control over their people, and it looks like they're rolling out an entirely new way to spy on the public. Beijing plans to launch its social credit system nationwide by 2020 to rate the trustworthiness of 1.3 billion people by assigning each individual a score. The system will take things into account such as credit history, contract obligation fulfillment, personal characteristics, behavior and preferences, and
we first took a look at the Chinese government's proposed social credit system back in early 2016 in an interview I did at the time with Oxford academic Roger Creamers. And since then, the initiative has come a long way. Given that China has around 1.5 billion citizens, managing the data on all those people is going to be an enormous undertaking. Beijing says that giving every individual a personal social credit rating is about strengthening society. But not surprisingly, skeptics abound, including Adam Greenfield.
I think most of us in the Western world are familiar with the notion of a credit score, which is applied to us by commercial credit bureaus, and which attempts to tabulate our reliability, our trustworthiness, and that we may be confronted with this score when we go to apply for a loan or for a job or for education. It's sort of a gating mechanism, and it's escaped the contours of what it was originally intended to do. As the name implies, it was really only ever supposed to assess whether we were worthy of being extended commercial credit. But it's being used elsewhere in our societies as a more general way of determining our reliability, our harmoniousness, our ability to get along with the rules of the day. The Chinese have taken this notion and run with it in an elaborate and an extensive public-private partnership that extends almost across the whole of civil society, so that, for example, you have a single numeric score that captures whether or not you are considered to be a member in good standing of Chinese society. And this is affected by things like your political articulations and the things that you say on social media. It's affected by whether or not you've gotten any speeding tickets or whether you've been seen to take out the recycling in your community. All of these things, public and private, are folded into this score. So behavior both online and off. And then this score is used to regulate your access to the things of the good life, you know, extending from whether or not you're able to take the national high-speed rail network, whether or not you're able to book air passage anywhere, whether you are able to shop for certain things, even whether your children get into a good school or not. So given the Chinese government's very pervasive ability to control mobility through the country and outside the country, given their very pervasive ability to regulate conduct, both online and off, we have reason to be concerned that this new social credit score really will effectively suppress any sort of dissent or even the thought that people would be comfortable with acting in a way that's different from the people around them. It's quite draconian and is already coming to bite. It has teeth.
And it's based on the power of ubiquitous computing, isn't it?
In a very, very large sense, yes. I mean, one of the things that we saw coming some time ago in the West when we first started talking about ubiquitous computing, or what is now known as the Internet of Things, is the idea that with these sensors distributed in every object, surface, and relation of our lives, a very, very wide array of behaviors can get picked up by the network and characterized, you know, through data analysis. And this is, in fact, what the Chinese have gone ahead and done. So even things now like the personal health monitors that we wear begin to feed into the social credit score. Are you seen to be a harmonious member of society in all of your public and private actions, in the things you do inside the home, in the things you do in public, in the things that you do possibly in private on a communication channel between two or just a few people? And as I say, this isn't something that we didn't see coming, but all of us who did see it coming and warned about it, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, we were in the position of a Cassandra. Our warnings fell on deaf ears. And the overwhelming convenience of so many of these products and services seems to have swayed the day. People invited these things into our lives. And we invited them into our lives in my country. I'm sure they invite them into our lives in Australia and the Chinese people as well.
so ambitious is this Chinese data initiative that Simona Mistrianu doubts it will end up as one big centrally administered system. Mistrianu is a Beijing-based correspondent for the German news agency DPA, and she recently wrote an article for Foreign Policy after visiting several of the 36 pilot systems that have been put in place in smaller urban centres.
Based on my research for this story, this sort of overarching scheme that would rank all 1.4 billion citizens is not doable, is not achievable because of technical reasons and because of political reasons. Like the government now, after having tested the social credit system in various forms, has learned that it's very important that it be embraced by people. So people need, this is a critical point about how the government is building the social credit system. People need to understand or feel that the social credit system is to their benefit, is for their benefit, that it will improve their lives, that if they maintain high scores, that they will get access to better loans, they will get access to maybe better schools for their children, their neighborhoods will have higher property prices. So it's important that it's embraced by society. System that would rank every one of China's 1.4 billion citizens is unachievable at this point, based on the researchers, Chinese and foreign researchers that I talked to.
So the idea then might be not one sort of overarching system, but a series of different systems providing different scores depending on what is being ranked. Is that correct?
Exactly, exactly. And this is easier to implement. And this also kind of shifts some of the responsibility for creating such systems on people themselves. Because if a neighborhood or a business decides to create its own version of the social credit system, then people in the end, like people who are affected by that scheme, will be better behaved and will be in line with everything the government wants them to do. And at the same time, the government doesn't have to be concerned with running like microsystem.
So what does the Chinese government, what does it say that it hopes to achieve from this type of scheme, from these types of arrangements?
Their official aim for the social credit system is to promote trustworthiness. In one of the founding documents of the social credit system from 2014, the government said that the plan is to have the trustworthy roam freely everywhere under the sky while making it difficult for people who are untrustworthy to make a single step. So they're saying that they want to create an environment where, like, first of all, people can trust businesses, and then they can trust each other. And one of the main arguments for the need for the system is that the government says that China's market economy has developed very quickly, and it hasn't had the time to regulate itself over decades, like in the West, for example. So then it needs a tool like this to make sure that it works properly, that people can have trust in the market, and that it avoids like major potential damages.
But giving individual communities or local government bodies the ability to develop their own social credit scheme as part of a wider web is not without its own potential problems.
In one of the neighborhoods that I went to in Rongcheng, residents had added their own categories to their own social credit system, and it included practicing illegal religions and spreading rumors online and like things that kind of approach this direction of, speaking out against the party. So there is this risk that the social credit system might be used in ways that are similar to what happened during the Cultural Revolution in China in 1966 to 1976, when people were pursued and attacked based on their ideology and based on their class and whether they were intellectuals or workers. So there are many, many concerning parallels between where the social credit system might go and China's fairly recent history.
2020 is the date that is being touted as the kind of introduction of the system nationwide. Mm-hmm. Looking ahead, I know it's always difficult to speculate on these kind of things, but looking ahead, what do you see in 2020 from the research you've done and the people that you've talked to? What kind of system do you see operating from 2020?
It's very hard to say now what the social credit system will look like in 2020. Even the researchers that I talk to who are in charge of designing the system at like Peking University, for example, don't have a clear idea now. I think it depends a lot on the feedback that the government gets from people, because again, it's very important to them at this point that the system is embraced by people. So it might be like a collection of a network of more independent but connected social credit systems, or it might be something more well-defined, but it's hard to say at this point.
Simona Mistriano in Beijing. And lest you think that such a system, for bad or good, could never happen in a democratic Western country, well, Adam Greenfield says, think again.
Yeah, I think that is a real possibility. I think that there are some, if not unique, then certainly idiosyncratic characteristics of the Chinese state that do tend to make it more likely that it would happen in a place like that. There is an unusually close degree of collaboration between large Chinese technological enterprises and the state, and the boundaries between these things are very often blurred. So you could absolutely imagine something like this happening elsewhere, where there's that very close, almost cronyistic connection between private enterprise and the state. You know, in Western societies, we tend to swing back and forth like a pendulum. You know, there are times in which the state sees its role as being riding herd on aggressive corporations, and there are times when the state sees itself as facilitating, you know, its highest and best purposes to facilitate the functions of these private enterprises. And during those swings of the pendulum, yes, I do think it's very, very credible that this sort of end-to-end social control that is now being installed in China could be introduced into Western societies. I don't think that's beyond question at all.
What are the social implications of this kind of system? I mean, obviously, for individuals, it's easy to see how they could be discriminated against, but what's the effect likely to be on urban life in general, do you think?
I think urban life generates value and meaning out of diversity. I think that cities are almost by definition places where difference encounters difference. And when you try to suppress that difference, when you try to flatten out behavior and expression, you really do cut the foundations out from under the things which generate everything beautiful and wonderful about urban life. And so that's a concern for me, you know, frankly, that in forcing people to internalize the idea that they had better behave in a certain way, otherwise there will be very, very real sanctions enacted against them. People, you know, they do internalize that. They become timid. They become afraid. They don't act differently. They don't express themselves differently. They don't dress differently. They may not be comfortable to practice their religion in public. They may not be comfortable expressing even moderate political opinions if they're not sure that they're shared by the other people around them. And this tends to erode everything that makes a city what it is. You know, cities are not the suburbs, and they are not the countryside. They're places where people gather specifically to be around people who don't think exactly the same way as they do, and don't dress exactly the same way as they do, and don't cook the same foods that they do. And I think that this is a beautiful and a wonderful thing, but beyond that, it's generative of very real value in every register. And I think to suppress that vitality and to suppress that difference in diversity is to do a disservice to the fundamental nature of urban innovation and creativity.
Urbanist Adam Greenfield. And if you haven't read his latest book, it's called Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life, and it's out now. Thanks as always to Karin Savanovitz and Dave White. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.